from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a first glimpse from a galaxy far, far away.
This is a remarkable achievement, and this is the strongest evidence that we have to date for the existence of black holes.
Validating Einstein and observing what we long thought was unobservable. Also today, the race for money and the race for the Democratic presidential primary. And...
yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the old town road.
A song by Lil Nas X was trending on Billboard's country music charts until Billboard took it off the charts because it wasn't country enough. But what does that mean?
When I found out Billboard took it off the country charts, you know why? It's like, wait a minute, something's not right, basically.
What it says about racism and the country music industry. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with a question that sounds like something out of science fiction. How do we observe what we've long thought was unobservable? And what does it look like? Well, the answer to that first question, take a picture of it.
We have seen and taken a picture of a black hole. Here it is.
And that's a group of astronomers and scientists at a news conference in Washington, D.C. today as they celebrated the first image ever taken and ever seen of a black hole some 55 million light years away from Earth. Among that group today were scientists from MIT's Haystack Observatory, including Dr. Vincent Fish of the Event Horizon Telescope Imaging Group that delivered the photos. And Vincent Fish joins us via Skype now. Dr. Fish, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So explain in your words the significance of this day.
Well, for me personally, this is very significant. I've been involved with the project since 2007, back when we were three sites, four observatories. And back in those days, we did not have enough telescopes to make an image. And it seemed like it would take forever for us to constitute an array to actually be able to make an image. That seems like so long ago, and yet it also seems like practically yesterday. But actually making an image is, I'm glad to be able to do that.
So describe, we've got it on our website, by the way, at radioboston.org, but describe what this image looks like. I'll take a stab at it. It's kind of an orange donut surrounded by black. Is that a fair description? What would you add?
Sure. So we're looking at the hot plasma that's surrounding it. It's basically ring-like, and it's brighter on one side than the other.
Right. And listen, back up for us. Remind us exactly what we're looking at. And by that, I mean, what exactly is a black hole?
Sure. A black hole is a concentration of matter so dense that it curves space-time to the extent that even light can't escape from it.
Right. So, and obviously it's never been seen in a way up until this point. It's sort of a theoretical idea, but tell us how this image is put together of something 55 million light years away from Earth. It boggles the mind.
Sure. So we're fortunate that this black hole is surrounded by material because obviously you can't see the black hole itself. Even light can't escape it. But the black hole in M87 is accreting material, and as that material falls in toward the black hole, it gets very, very hot and therefore very, very bright. And so that backlights the black hole so you can see it.
Right. And can you place it in the galaxy for us? Where is it in relation to the Earth and to the Sun?
Well, it's in the center of the M87 galaxy, which is in the Virgo cluster. So if you go outside and look for the constellation Virgo, it's somewhere near there. To put that in perspective, the size of the black hole itself is bigger than our solar system.
So what's the next step? What does this photo offer you and your team, and what's next?
So there are a few next steps. One is to reobserve the source in the future. So if you look at the papers, there appears to be a slight change in the structure from the first two nights that we observed it to the last two nights, which were separated by almost a week. And it's a little bit too early to say for certain whether that's because material around the black hole was moving or whether that's purely an instrumental effect. And so to have more data in the future will help answer that question.
Well, that's Dr. Vincent Fish. He's with MIT's Haystack Observatory and part of Event Horizon Telescope Imaging Group that delivered the photo today of the first photo today of a black hole. Dr. Vincent Fish, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we want to talk a little bit more about this. And to do that, we're going to welcome science writer Marcia Bartuszak. She joins us via Skype from Sudbury, Mass. And Marcia, welcome back to the program. Great to have you.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So what's your reaction to this first photo of a black hole? This is pretty exciting stuff, right?
It is extremely exciting. I was jumping up and down this morning. I knew it was coming, but to actually see it is quite a thrill, especially since physicists and astronomers have been struggling with this idea for more than 100 years. And to, you know, now seeing is believing.
Yeah. And say a little bit more about that. I mean, does this validates, you say more than 100 years, it validates theories by Einstein, for example, right?
Yes. It comes out of Einstein's general theory of relativity, and by using those equations, astronomers and physicists could see that there was a massive enough star that when it ran out of fuel and collapsed, gravity taking over, all that matter would collapse to a point, causing, as was mentioned before, space-time to literally curve in on itself, creating this pit in space-time.
It's amazing. You know, I'm reading a quote from, I'm going to get this name wrong, Priyamavda Natarajan, an astrophysicist at Yale. He says, "Einstein must be totally chuffed. His theory has just been stress tested under conditions of extreme gravity and looks like that it held up."
Yes. In fact, she also mentioned that it's wrapping the light around, so it's like seeing the back of your head.
Yeah. But is it true that he was, even though he sort of theorized their existence, he was resistant to the idea of black holes, right?
Yeah. It was a result of his equations. He actually didn't predict the existence of a black hole. That came from a German astronomer, Karl Schwarzschild. But when Einstein heard about it, he could not stand the idea. He believed that nature just wouldn't work that way. And in fact, he wrote an infamous paper in 1939 trying to prove they couldn't possibly exist, and it's called The Worst Paper He Ever Wrote.
Hmm. So help me with this, because I am so definitely not a science geek, Marcia, but I'm still having trouble understanding how we have an image of something 50 million, do I have that number right, 50 million light years away?
About 55 million light years away. Some have compared it to reading a newspaper in New York from a cafe in Berlin.
Yeah, right. So how does it work? Can you explain the technology that they use to capture this image?
Yeah, exactly. Essentially, we all know that the bigger a telescope, the farther out and the more details you can see. And essentially, what they have created artificially is a telescope as big as the Earth. They have eight telescopes, radio telescopes, set around the world in Chile, Hawaii, Arizona, all the Antarctica, and they record the data, take this data to a central location, and merge it. And essentially, that then creates an image that is equivalent to having a telescope as big as the Earth.
Wow, it's truly extraordinary. So now that we have this photo, what more do we need to know about black holes and how they work? Or where does, you know, is there still mystery, I guess, in all of this? And how do we unravel that?
Yes, this is just the first image. You know, science is done by collecting lots of data, and this was a tremendous accomplishment. But the real science gets done, and they are adding telescopes to this network called the Event Horizon Telescope. And by adding more telescopes, they have more, in a sense, surface area of their telescope to collect more light, more data. And the more they'll get insights on how light and matter react in this highly curved area of space-time, which is testing Einstein's general theory of relativity to the ultimate limit. So really, they want to keep stretching and stretching, getting closer and closer, getting more details, until they might see a breaking point where Einstein's equations no longer hold up. And that means they might have to amend the theory of gravity. Huh. We're always, science is always testing, always trying to go out to the boundaries and test the extremes.
Really fascinating. So how much do we understand, if anything? Okay, so let me ask the question this way. So here's an image of a black hole from far, far away. But how much do we understand of what's happening inside a black hole? And is that sort of the next dream of somehow getting a glimpse of being able to peer inside?
Well, right now, with our classical rules of physics, there is no way to peer into a black hole, because once light gets in, it can't come back out, and we can't get it. We can't retrieve it. There is no way. All we have is modeling. And no one knows what's happening inside a black hole. There's really two different stories. If you use the classical rules of physics, general relativity, it says that all that matter plummets to the center and concentrates itself into a point called the singularity. Perhaps it even punches through space-time and creates a new universe. There's crazy theories out there that each time a black hole is born, it's creating a new universe in another dimension. But then if you look at it through the lens of atomic physics on the microscopic scale, and the rules are not complete. String theory, they're trying to work this out. The theory of quantum gravity, what does gravity look like on the atomic scale? They don't know yet, but they have guesses. Some think that when you enter through the event horizon, you don't plummet to the center. You might face this firewall of particles and space-time breaking up. No one knows what's happening inside. They need a good theory of quantum gravity to get some understanding.
So, big mystery. And you've written about how black holes went from sort of an obscure idea to being really integral to the way we think about the universe. So how have they explained why they're so important in understanding the complexity of the universe?
Well, black holes provide, you know, they serve as test objects to really understand the mightiest force in the universe, which is gravity. I mean, think of the 19th century when James Clerk Maxwell came up with his laws of electricity and magnetism. Well, at that time, it had a few uses, but basically in that horse-drawn carriage era, it didn't really have many applications. And lo and behold, now it's at the center of our high-tech universe. Well, black holes are serving in the same way. They are serving as an inroad, insights into understanding gravity, because it tests gravity at its most extreme case. And more than that, very recently, over the last decade or so, they're coming to see that supermassive black holes, these are black holes with the mass of millions and billions of solar masses, inhabit each and every galaxy, nearly each and every galaxy in the universe, which means that they may be somehow linked to the very formation of a galaxy. So in some ways, the existence of a black hole may lead to the existence of us. We may be dependent on black holes to even exist in the universe.
Wow. Well, that science writer, Marcia Bartuszak, she joins us from Sudbury. And she's the author, by the way, of a book called Black Hole, How an Idea Abandoned by Newtonians, Hated by Einstein, and Gambled on by Hawking Became Beloved. And today we got our first glimpse of a black hole. Marcia, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciated it.
I enjoyed it myself.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll take a look at Senator Elizabeth Warren's tax returns and the race for money in the Democratic primary. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Well, we all know tax day is approaching, but Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren isn't waiting until April 15th to release her tax returns. Warren made her 2018 return public this morning, joining a group of Democratic presidential contenders who are making years of their financial information available as they get ready for the 2020 presidential race. Warren also announced her campaign raised $6 million in her first 3 months as a candidate, falling short of several of her Democratic rivals. Here to talk about the push for financial transparency and fundraising on Democratic primary, our Boston Globe political reporters, James Pindle. James, great. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be back.
And on the phone, Jess Bidgood is with us as well. Jess, great to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So first, Jess, let me start with you. What does Warren's tax return reveal? What do we learn?
Sure. So Warren put out her 2018 tax return this morning, as you said, and she and her husband, Bruce Mann, who's a professor at Harvard Law School, reported a combined adjusted gross income of $846,394. They had a little more than $230,900 in total taxes. So that's a drop of about $67,000 in adjusted gross income from last year.
Right. And they're worth multiple millions of dollars, right?
Yeah. According to financial disclosure forms that Warren has filed, both with the Senate and to run for president, they are worth somewhere in the neighborhood of between about $4 million and $11 million. The reason I'm giving such a large range is that those forms, you report your income in big ranges. So it's hard to say exactly for sure.
Right.
But they are millionaires.
Right. And so what do we know from other Democrats' tax returns about what they're worth?
So the tax return doesn't tell you exactly what someone's worth, right? But it does tell you what their income looks
right,
like.
Right.
And Democratic candidates are really emphasizing their own transparency. They're all competing with each other to take on President Trump, who of course famously has not released his own tax returns, which defies a long-held norm of what you do when you run for president. And so they're all kind of trying to show that they are going to be an open book about it.
Right.
So Amy Klobuchar has recently released 12 years of tax returns. Kirsten Gillibrand has released multiple years of tax returns and was the first candidate to release her 2018 tax return. And Jay Inslee has done the same as well.
Right. Well, you mentioned, of course, this long-standing issue of the president not releasing his tax returns. Today is the deadline set by Ways and Means Committee Chairman Richard Neal for the IRS to turn over 6 years' worth of the president's returns. Here's President Trump speaking to reporters about this earlier today.
I would love to give them, but I'm not going to do it while I'm under audit. It's very simple. Remember, I got elected last time, the same exact issue.
So James Spindle, he says, I'd love to give them, but I'm not going to do it while I'm still under audit. He's been saying that for a long time. Any chance we're going to see these returns?
It's unclear. Yeah. I mean, I think the truth is that this is going to be tied up in courts for a long time. And that is obviously part of the president's strategy here, both the legal strategy eventually and, of course, the political strategy. Some legal experts say that you need to have a point to see these tax returns. And so the clever thing that the Chairman Neal is trying to do is to create a point to see, for example, if there are things that the president is the IRS is not doing correctly with the president's particular tax returns, if he is exactly under audit or not. That's sort of where we're starting the conversation. Others argue you need to go further and say, you know, we need to investigate impeachment before you actually get his tax returns to see where that goes. But clearly, this has been an issue for the president for a very long time. And I think one of the interesting things we saw recently was over the weekend, Senator Mitt Romney, now of Utah, of course, faced a lot of questions about him releasing his own tax returns when he was a presidential candidate. But now he is backing the president on not releasing his right now.
Well, it's been an issue for the president for – let me ask you both this question. I mean, it's been an issue for the president for a long, long time. But as the president just said, remember, I got elected last time, same exact issue. I mean, does he have a point in the sense that maybe at the end of the day, folks don't really care about it or not enough folks care about it? What do you think, James?
Well, I think he does have a point. I think the 2016 election was not about his tax returns, and it was about more deeper cultural issues going on and about an insecurity going on in terms of people's own personal economic lives, racism. There's a whole thing, a lot of things that election was about. And, yeah. And the 2020 election is going to be about a whole host of things as well. Whether or not we get to the nitty-gritty of releasing tax returns, it's just going to reinforce what those who do not like him want to do, and those who are backing him, whatever he decides, they will back him. So, you know, it is not the – it's not going to be the linchpin here of what people are going to be deciding on who they're going to vote for in 2020.
Right. Jess, do you think there's a chance that, I don't know, this could be an issue that might backfire on Democrats insisting on this tax return issue? How do you see this playing out?
Well, I mean, there's one thing that happens when Democrats release their tax returns and show how transparent they're being by drawing attention to their own financial information, and that's that people are going to look at what it says. And at a time when Democrats are, you know, vying to take on this very wealthy president, talking about economic inequality, talking about, the hollowing out of the middle class, and then putting out tax returns that show that that they themselves are doing quite well, that could be a little awkward. Elizabeth Warren is certainly not the only wealthy candidate in this race. Beto O'Rourke is reportedly worth about $9 million. Bernie Sanders told the New York Times just the other day that he has crossed into millionaire territory, too, because he wrote a best-selling book, as he says. So while they are looking for brownie points by kind of trumpeting their own transparency, that it may invite a little bit of extra scrutiny into their own finances as well.
Interesting. So, James, I want to come back to you and talk about April 15th, also the deadline for presidential candidates to report their first quarter fundraising. We learned that the Warren campaign had raised $6 million in the first 3 months. How does that compare to the other candidates?
Well, she's in fifth place, if we want to count just the top line of how much money is coming in. It really is a situation of Bernie Sanders, who announced he raised $18.2 million, and then pretty much everybody else after that. So in that sense, she's in that top-ish tier. But when you want to go deeper in the numbers, I think it actually – maybe you should focus less on the actual top line of her $6 million versus $18.2 and really get into what the game is on this 2020 race, because it's fundamentally different in a lot of ways than it has been in previous years.
Now,
it's all about small dollar recurring donations. Mm-hmm. It was that way, of course, in the midterm elections. It was the way to a degree in 2016 with Bernie Sanders, and even in 2008 when with Barack Obama and even Howard Dean. But now it is not just this interesting thing about a percentage that makes up your total donations. It is, in Elizabeth Warren's case, the entire way she is going to raise all of her money. So if you want to look at just the amount of recurring donations, and why this matters is that every month she knows that she will be getting, you know, X amount of money that she can rely on and not just tap out rich donors who can't give to her again. In terms of the actual individual donors, I mean, yes, Bernie Sanders and then everyone else, but she is very much in the hunt with Pete Buttigieg, Kamala and Kamala Harris around the, you know, 130 to 160 130,000, 160,000 individual contributors. And that's just really going to matter. Those are the email solicitations you get, the $5, $10 that people can give every single month. And that's really where the game is right now. And if that's where the game is, particularly early on, she's very much in the hunt.
All right. So now this might sound obvious, but let's talk about why money like this is actually important for running in a primary, James? I mean, it's not everything, but it's also the lifeblood of politics, right?
That's right. I think right now these fundraising numbers matter really for a couple of reasons, just politically speaking. One, I mean, yes, do you have the money you need to run the campaign you want to run? So if you are a candidate who says, I'm only going to campaign in Iowa or New Hampshire, that's about it, and then see if I can catch on, great. If you're going to run a national campaign, it obviously takes more money. For Elizabeth Warren and for a number of these candidates, they basically have the amount of money that they need to run the campaign that they're going to run. Second, you want to look for support. You know, the old adage is if someone is going to give you $25, they're probably going to give you their vote. Now, this cycle, that may be a bit different because different people and maybe many listeners are giving to multiple candidates, trying to help them get on to qualify, for example, for the debate stage. But more or less, if you have enthusiasm, people want to give you money, it's a sign of support. It's a sign that things are going well for you. And another one is that there's a sense of how the narrative is building. You know, we have 20 candidates running for president. We have no sense on who exactly is the front runners in the next 3 months. We know who they are in polling right now, but we have no sense of, is it young versus old? Is it left versus moderate? We just don't really have our sense of where this thing is going to shake out. And these numbers do give some early structure that really do demonstrate that with Biden, obviously, former Vice President Joe Biden waiting in the wings on whether he's going to decide to run or not. Right now, currently, it is Bernie Sanders and then everyone else. And then there are some different tiers here. And then obviously you do see with some of the, in these numbers that Pete Buttigieg, for example, the hype has really played out for him.
He's able to raise
more than Elizabeth Warren did.
Yeah, looking at these numbers, Jess, I'll come to you for this. I think the thing that sort of stood out to me most was the Pete Buttigieg numbers, because there's been a lot of buzz around him recently. And as James just mentioned, he's raised more money than Elizabeth Warren, who just a short while ago was arguably at least approaching front runner status before Bernie Sanders got in the race anyway. But good news for Pete Buttigieg here, right?
Well, it is. It is. And, you know, if you had told me a year ago that the person to beat to show that you're doing well in fundraising was going to be the mayor of South Bend, I might not have believed you. But elections are unpredictable, as we know, and here we are. So Buttigieg has really been able to harness a lot of early enthusiasm, and he made a smart call, which I'm seeing other candidates echo, where he has said to supporters, hey, you don't have to vote for me, but donate so I get in the debate, donate so more people can learn what I'm about. And just the other week, Warren's team sent out a fundraising email with a kind of similar appeal, where they said, hey, you may not vote for us, or you may not be ready to commit your support to us, but donate if you want to keep Elizabeth in the race and you want to keep her ideas out there. So I think campaigns are starting to encourage people to give to multiple candidates, to give to them even if they're not ready to vote for them yet, in a bid to kind of keep those dollars flowing. And it'll be interesting to see how many donors decide to do that, to divide their resources instead of sending it straight to one person.
You know, Anthony, just point out something that's very important in these first quarter numbers. Of course, it's one piece of the puzzle here on how these campaigns are going to proceed. But the first winnowing down process of how we get from 20 candidates into further to get down to a little bit more of a manageable size will be these summer debates. And there's two ways to qualify. One, you have to have at least 1% in three different polls, whether those are early state polls or national polls, you know, some baseline of support. And the second way is to qualify by showing you have at least 65,000 individual contributors to your campaign. And we don't have to get into the nitty-gritty of the weeds, but basically diverse into amongst about 20 states. And so, you know, when Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg or others make the appeal, can you just get me on the debate stage? Those who do not make the debate stage, I don't know how they continue on. So these fundraising numbers right now are actually a very important metric beyond just how much money you have in the bank account.
All right. That's
absolutely
really important point there. So that's James Pindle and Jess Bidgood, political reporters for the Boston Globe, talking about some of the money and the race for money and the disclosures about money among the Democrats running for president. Thank you both for joining us today. Thank you, Jess.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, James.
Thank you.
What does the now closed Mount Ida College owe the students suddenly displaced from its Newton campus? That question is now making its way through federal court. WBUR's Fred Tice reports on a lawsuit designed to win compensation for displaced Mount Ida students.
Gabby Erickson-Wenners was one of those students. She's standing, sleeveless, apparently oblivious to the cold, outside the federal courthouse in Boston.
Honestly, I would like to see where things went wrong. If they get away with it, what does that mean for other colleges?
Erickson-Wenners was a sophomore at Mount Ida when the college announced it was closing the next month. Not enough notice, she says.
I mean, the day that they gave us notice, schools had already closed up the doors for any form of admissions.
She's a junior at UMass Dartmouth now, but Erickson-Wenners says her education is not quite the same. UMass Dartmouth took over the game development program she was in at Mount Ida, but UMass Dartmouth is still developing its program, she says, and by the time she graduates, she won't have the skills she needs, and she'll have to get a graduate degree.
The fundamental question in this case has to do with what is the obligation of an institution for higher learning to its students?
Michael Tower is an attorney for students suing Mount Ida.
There could be a duty that arises out of contract. It's our position that the students paid tuition. That was not a donation to Mount Ida. They were expecting something in return, and it's our position they didn't get it. There could be a fiduciary duty, which is a legal duty where someone is obligated to look out for somebody else the way an attorney might look out for a client, a doctor might look out for a patient, a trustee might look out for a beneficiary. It's our position that a school is not just a business making widgets.
The lawsuit is funded by Bob Hildreth. He's the principal funder of WBUR's Edify. The students seek $40 million to offset the time and opportunities they lost and the loans some have had to take out to go to other colleges. Courtroom 21 was packed with former students and their parents. One of the attorneys for the students, Andra Hutchins, faced a lot of questions from Judge Richard Stearns, including about what a school must do if it's closing. Where in the law does it say that a school is required to give notice? He asked Hutchins. She pointed to the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education regulations, which require schools to come up with a closure plan. Do the regulations allow legal action? Stearns asked. Where is the private cause of action? There were no statements that the college was closing, Hutchins replied. As recently as the previous fall, she pointed out, the college was advertising its generous financial aid. It's the omissions that are the issue, Hutchins said. An omission is still false information.
Former President Brown, Mount Ida, its trustees, for now almost a year have been getting bashed unfairly in the court of public opinion.
Howard Cooper, who represents former Mount Ida President Barry Brown, points out that his client is now in the court of law.
And our argument very clearly is that sometimes there are unfortunate results despite everybody's best actions, and it doesn't mean that someone did anything wrong. And the reality of it here is none of the folks at Mount Ida did anything wrong, and to the contrary, worked themselves 24/7 to try to save a school that they loved, and they were just unsuccessful.
Cooper says Brown certainly would like to have succeeded.
So when the college failed, he was devastated. So what would he do different? Anything that could have saved the college. But in terms of putting the students' interests first, in terms of trying to make the college work, I don't think that there's anything that he could have done different or that they didn't at least think about trying.
Mount Ida's attorneys argue a college has no fiduciary duty to its students except to provide physical security and no contractual obligation beyond teaching the courses students have already paid for. Those are two of the issues Judge Stearns must consider as he decides whether the students have a case.
WBUR's Fred Tice reporting there about an effort to win compensation for students displaced by the closing of Mount Ida College. Stay with us. Still ahead, music from Lil Nas X and the question, is it country enough? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
Yeah, I'm going to take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm going to ride till I can't no more. I'm going to take my horse.
Let's talk about a song that just a little while ago was trending on Billboard's country music chart.
I got the horses in the back. Horse stock is attached. Head is matted black. Got the boots black to match. Riding on a horse.
The song is Old Town Road by Lil Nas X, about horses, lonely roads, and the spirit of a cowboy. It was charting on Billboard's country music charts until Billboard took it off the charts, suggesting it wasn't country enough. But then Billy Ray Cyrus, a country music legend, disagreed and recorded a version of the song with Lil Nas X that sounds like this.
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse through the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I got the horses in the back.
All right, so now is it country enough now that the white guy is singing along? Well, that question has ignited controversy and a conversation about racism in the country music industry. So what defines a country song, and whose music is left out of that definition? Joining me first is Renee Graham. She's a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Renee, always great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Anthony.
So what strikes you about this? Billboard took the song off the charts, saying to Rolling Stone that the song does not embrace enough elements of today's country music to chart in its current version. Do you buy that explanation, or what's going on here?
Well, I think you have to define what does it mean when you say today's country music. To me, today's country music sounds quite pop.
Yeah.
So I don't really see how Lil Nas X doesn't fit into that. You know, the first time I heard the song, I thought of it as a country song with hip-hop stylings. But for me, Southern hip-hop has always sounded a little country, whether you're talking about Bubba Sparks or Nelly. So I didn't hear this song and think, wow, what is that doing on country radio, or why would that be on the country charts? It's a country song.
Yeah. So I want to bring Lil Nas X's voice into this. So here he is speaking with Genius about finding out that his song had been taken off the country charts. Here's what he said.
When I found out Billboard took it off the country charts, like before, like, It was even taken off the country charts, I was just happy to be on Billboard at all. And, like, even after they did take it off, I'm like, okay, at least I'm still on Billboard. But then it was, like, I started to think about, I was like, you know, why? After, like, listening to other songs that's actually on that chart, it's like, wait a minute, something's not right, basically.
So something's not right, basically. And what's he referring to there, Renee?
I mean, I think he's wondering why, as a black artist, he was taken off of the country Billboard charts. There have been other black artists recently on the Billboard charts, Kane Brown and Jimmy Allen. But I think with Lil Nas X, his sense is like, look, I feel like I made a country song, and if it's making an impact on the charts, why would you single me out and remove my music?
Yeah. So all this,
you know, it's worth wondering about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And Renee, we've talked to you a little about this in the past. I mean, there's some historic precedent here. Not long ago, we talked about this super famous musician who was completely ignored by country radio stations when he first delved into country. Here he is.
Hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
So, of course, we're talking about the great Ray Charles when he released the 62 album Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. And, Renee, what happened there?
You know, there were a lot of people who were put off by that. You know, they didn't, you know, you didn't have a lot of black artists in country music. And Ray Charles, in a lot of ways, took country music and did it in a Ray Charles style. So it had an R&B textures to it. It had jazz to it. And people didn't really appreciate that. And there was a lot of pushback, you know, despite the fact that this is considered sort of one of the great albums of the 20th century.
Right. So do you see a sort of straight line from sort of what ailed country, the country music industry, if you will, back then to the controversy to today with Lil Nas X?
Well, you know, I think there's two things. One, I think, you know, again, black artists have always been part of country music. You can think of people like Charlie Pride. But I think there's also been an unspoken rule that you have to be more country than black.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So I think that's one of the problems. I also think there's a kind of genre purity with country, and that's really resistant to change. And it kind of reminds me of in the 70s and the 80s when you had a punk band, The Clash, that started to incorporate hip-hop and reggae into their music. You know, sort of these really traditional hardcore punk fans didn't appreciate that because they felt that it was drifting too far away from what they thought the music should be. But then it kind of, you know, they keep the music in one place, the music gets stagnant, and it doesn't invite other listeners in.
Hmm. Renee, stand by. I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Joining us right here in the studio is Susan Cataneo. She's an associate professor of songwriting at Berklee College of Music. She's also a country music singer and Americana singer-songwriter. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
It's great. It's great to have you. Now, so you teach songwriting, music history. What are the core tenets of a country song?
Well, it's so interesting because obviously the core tenets of country music have been up to this point something related to family, something related to farming, land, and faith, certainly usually Christianity in that sense, and then also love.
Yeah.
And obviously the heterosexual kind at this point. But I completely agree with Renee in saying that, you know, it's really not – I don't think Billboard's responsibility to determine like what is a pure country song, because if we're going to talk about that, probably 85% of what's on country radio right now is breaking the rules. It is essentially pop music with a little bit of a twang in the vocal, and you know, maybe they'll add a pedal steel, but you know, it isn't country music in its purest sense. You know?
Listen to this. So Billy Ray Cyrus issued a defense of the song and its country roots, and he tweeted, "I was thinking, what's not country about it? What's the rudimentary element of a country and western song? Then I thought, it's honest, humble, it has an infectious hook, and a banjo. What more do you need?" Is he right about that?
I think he is, actually. And if you think about back in the 1980s when Shania Twain came onto the scene and her husband was the producer of AC/DC. And so he incorporated AC/DC style 70s rock foundational stuff into country music. Yeah. And at that point, there was a little bit of blowback because people were like, that's not country music. That's not the Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton, Coal Miner's Daughter kind of country. But, you know, country is essentially a mass market genre. And so they're always going to be responding and adopting to what the current music is doing. And I think right now innovation is happening in hip hop and in rap music. Hmm. So it's kind of natural that country music would start adopting that as well.
So what's your response to then the Billboard taking this song down off the country music charts?
I think it's terrible. Yeah. And I think, I mean, I can't, it's very interesting to me that if you look at, I don't know, Bebo Rexha and Florida Georgia Line doing a song that is essentially a pop song. Why aren't they taken off Billboard? I find it really interesting that a hip hop artist and an African American is being taken off the charts. I don't think that's the right thing.
Right, Renee, you obviously agree with that.
I could not agree more. I mean, you know, Florida Georgia Line gets a lot of pushback. You know, they have their current album is called "I Can't Say I Ain't Country." You know, so they hear it a lot from people because they've worked with people like Ziggy Marley and Jason Derulo. And for some purist country fans, that breaks the rules. But again, they're not taken off the country charts. If the records are selling, they're on the chart.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, it does make you wonder what's going on here. Although, I mean, I think I have a feeling of what's going on here.
Right, right. But, I mean, is it – so maybe this is the wrong question to ask, but I'll come to you with this, Susan. I mean, Lil Nas X, is it important to ask, is he a country music artist, or is that not the point? He's doing music that – can be interpreted as country music.
I think so. I think he's using,
right.
You know, is it a country music song? Yeah, maybe not. Maybe it's like more of a trap song, I think, in its style and how it sounds. But he's certainly using various lyric elements that you find in country music. I think that he perceives himself, you look at him, like he perceives himself, he is adopting the cowboy swagger and the cowboy, you know, it's almost like he's wearing a costume. So does that make him, he's from Atlanta. Is he authentic? Is he authentically country? Mm. I don't know. But, you know, I'm trying to think of somebody else. I mean, there are other artists who are from the Northeast. Does that make them inauthentically country? I don't think
I mean, Jimmy Allen. I'm sorry.
Right. No.
Just say Jimmy Allen is from Delaware.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
So, and you know, he did fine, and people felt like what he was doing was authentically country enough. Mm-hmm. So I think it's always, and people forget, the Pointer Sisters won their first Grammy in a country category for the song Fairy Tale, and they're from Oakland, California.
Right.
Renee, I'm glad you mentioned Jimmy Allen, because we've got some music of his that we want to play. So Jimmy Allen, a black country singer who's received a Country Music Award nomination this year for New Male Vocalist. So here he is singing Best Shot.
I'm just flesh and bone, heart and soul, and I've earned a couple scars. I've lived once in a lifetime kind of things slide right out of my arms. I struck out, I've been knocked down more times than
Jimmy Allen singing there. I'm laughing because I'm looking behind the glass in the control room, and our director Zoe Mitchell can't stand still because she's dancing to the music. But anyway, nice example there. But Susan, that's a very different sound than Lil Nas X. Again, maybe not the point of to the point that therefore he should be taken off the country music charts. I'm not saying that, but that sounded more country to me.
Well, I agree. Yeah. And I also would have to ask, does it sound like he is an African American singer? I wonder about that. You know, if you think about back to the 1950s, so the 1950s, the explosion of rock and roll happened because radio DJs started playing African American artists and white teenagers wanted to hear it. So they requested that. Mm-hmm. And the initial African American artists that came out were people like, Fats Domino, who wasn't very, I would say, threatening. And then you had somebody like Little Richard, who was definitely, 100% himself. And I wonder if country music has a bias. I mean, I got to say that. It's just that song for me, not that I don't like that song, but it sounds it's not necessarily referencing an African-American music like hip hop, like trap. Mm-hmm. It's not. That's a very kind of – it's what we've heard before.
Yeah. Renee, do you agree with that?
Oh, I do. I mean, but, I was thinking as I was listening to it, you sort of flipped the question around. He's a black artist, but would black radio play Jimmy Allen?
Yeah.
No.
No, that's interesting.
Probably not, because they would –
Wouldn't
know.
Touch it.
Well, but did black
– No, black radio
– Right. Sorry.
I do think black radio would play Lil Nas X. I do believe they'd play that, but I don't think they'd play Jimmy Allen or maybe even Kane Brown either, because it doesn't have what people expect to hear on black radio. It doesn't sound like R&B. It doesn't have a soul base. It doesn't sound church based, or it's not R&B. So I'm glad he found a country audience, but I don't know that black radio would embrace that, because there are these walls when it comes to genre and obviously the charts and radio.
Well, speaking of these walls, we spoke earlier today to music critic Tim Riley, who reminded us of this famous story about how a DJ down south first introduced the music of Elvis Presley, which, Elvis Presley obviously hugely influenced by black music on the radio. But here's what Tim said about that.
He said, "This kid goes to Hume's High." Why did he say that? Because it was a blues song. And he wanted everyone to know in the audience that this kid was white. People were going to mistake him for black. But they said, "This kid is from Hume's High. That's the white high school that made the blues playable on the radio."
Susan, you're nodding your head. Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been going on for a long time, this kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, if you listen to interviews of the guy that signed Elvis, he said that he initially had recorded black artists, and then he's like, "I knew that if I could find a white boy who could sing like a blues artist, I would make a lot of money."
Oh, boy.
And Sam Phillips did indeed do that.
Right. So, Renee, go ahead, Renee. I'm sorry.
Also, just one thing I do find interesting is that black radio traditionally will play anyone who sounds like an R&B or a soul artist. So black radio played Boz Scaggs and Tina Marie and The Clash is Magnificent Seven and Radio Clash, because those things sounded, quote unquote, like black music. So they don't have that line. If you have the sound, you get in, you get through the door. And in country music, that might not necessarily be the case.
So we have like 10 seconds left. But Susan, last question to you. I mean, what does all this say about the relevance or the lack of relevance of these music charts in the area, in the era of streaming music, of, you know, all of this is available everywhere all the time?
I mean, I think that that's a really good point. What is the point of these charts? What do they do? Are they just confining people to genres that really don't exist anymore? You know, if you talk about like, If you build it, they will come. People love this song by Lil Nas X. It doesn't matter what genre it is. People are requesting it, and so it's going to get played. Whether, you know, whether Billboard wants them to have it or not, it's going to get played.
All right. That's Susan Cataneo.
Cataneo.
Cataneo. I'm so sorry. We even talked about this before I went on the air, and I still blew it. I'm so sorry. Susan Cataneo, Associate Professor of Songwriting at Berklee College of Music. She's also a singer-songwriter. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having
sorry
me.
Sorry for mangling your name. And Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor. Renee, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again for more Radio Boston tomorrow.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.